ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
And a good day to you. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show. I'm joined by my colleagues, Alan Tonelson and Jim McTagg. We will begin immediately with our theme of the day, the week, the month, the year. The years left us on planet Earth, and then all those years in eternity watching AI and work. You understand that America loves to work. We've been working since we got here. And we're not quite Americans yet, but there's always something to do. We inherited a forest and a continent, and now there's work to do in the ether. The AI is a challenge that we three take on routinely, not because we want to, but because we have to. It's the nature of AI. It dips into your life and says, I'm volunteering to help you. Do you want my help? And you say, no. And then you think about it a little bit and go, well, what would that help look like? And AI smiles and goes to work. And so here we go to work. Gentlemen, a very good day to you. Alan, we're going to begin with a pastry anecdote,
okay,
updated from Lancaster County to make all of us hungry, but also to acknowledge that AI wants to do the right thing. But sometimes, Jim, a very good morning to you. As I recall, a week passed. You and I do our Lancaster report, and you had been at the Park City Mall where there was a pastry chef, French, and his wife, and she had a cart that she pushes around the mall for people to buy from very successfully. Enormous consumption of pastries under $10. So you wanted to know more about the pastry shop. And you went on AI. Please continue the story, Jim. Good morning.
Good morning, John. Now, remember, I live in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Dutch country. Okay. I mean, you come here and you visually see Germanicism all over the place. You feel like you're in a foreign country. So I inquire, how many French chefs can there be in Lancaster County?
All right, stop there, Jim. We'll start recording. You've set up. You've told the audience where we're going. How many French chefs? It feels like a question on Monopoly, doesn't it, Jim?
It does.
So, what was it? Community chess? How many French chefs?
We should ask AI.
Yes. How many? Well, he did, and that's the fun of this. Jim set the question up. So, gentlemen, we'll begin recording in just a moment. This goes from the making of the John Batchelor Show to the John Batchelor Show with Jim McTagg in Lancaster County and Alan Tonelson in the ether. But I could say you were within easy shouting distance of the Capitol, couldn't I, Alan?
Somewhat. To some extent, yes, if I shouted loud enough.
And what is the county you're in?
It's called Prince George's County.
Prince George.
It is the largest majority-minority county in the country. And the wealthiest African American population,
Prince George's,
in the country.
Prince George's.
That's right.
And it has the most dangerous highway in the area, the Indian Head Highway.
All right.
Oh my goodness! It's been decades since I've been on that for very good reason, as you just suggested.
Prince George's. Good. 5, 4, 3, 2. Thank you, gentlemen. 1. I'm John Batchelor. Artificial intelligence and work It concerns you, and if not yet, soon enough, or perhaps you're behind. We are doing what we can to stay even with the revelations of AI and work. I welcome my two colleagues on this endeavor, this expedition. Jim McTague, he is in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, the best county in the Keystone State. The former Washington editor of Barron's, now a novelist in Lancaster, fencing with AI. And Alan Tonnelson, my guide and guru on manufacturing and trade for many years. He blogs at Reality Check. Most importantly, he's in Prince George's County, within shouting distance of the nation's capital. And he also contends with AI. So we're learning together. We begin with an anecdote that is a continuation of a conversation Jim and I had about the economy of Lancaster. The economy of Lancaster is the economy of Keystone State. The economy of Pennsylvania, you bet, is the economy of the United States, which we're watching very carefully right now because of the violence in the Middle East and the global troubles with oil and natural gas. We begin, however, with French pastry. Jim, a very good day to you. As I recall, you traveled to the Park City Mall and you had a conversation, a very happy conversation, with a young woman pushing a cart filled with extremely attractive-looking and expensive pastry made by her husband, a French chef. It was all very happy, and we made ourselves hungry, and we made the audience hungry. And I learned later that sweets are what people in Tehran do after a bombing raid. It's compulsive of them. They take their flatbread, and they smear jam and anything sweet on it, and eat ravenously. It's a way of relieving the tension. I suspect that works for French chefs, too. However, your story continues. How many pastry chefs are there in Lancaster County? Please continue, Jim. A good day to you.
Good day, John. So to repeat, this is a Germanic county. If you find an Irishman, that's a minority. Italians are like aliens from another planet. Oh. So how many French chefs can there possibly be in Lancaster County? So the woman, actually, it's not a cart. It's a little kiosk that attracts shoppers like flies because the pastries are just so exquisite, so Parisian, so unusual, again, for this Germanic county. So I got on AI and I asked Gemini, who's the owner of the French, who's the French chef who owns the pastry stand in Park City Mall in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So Gemini came back with this story about a French chef who he started out with a restaurant in Lancaster. It went bankrupt and somebody else took it over. He ended up in Utah, Park City, Utah, where he now lives, and he owns the stand in the mall. And I thought to myself, that's not right. So it turned out that there have been two French chefs in Lancaster County. And I asked Gemini, I said, this story doesn't sound right. What about the Park City Mall? And Gemini apologized and said, oh, I'm sorry. I mixed up Park City, Utah with the Park City Mall in Lancaster. And then he mixed up the chefs and concocted this phenomenal story about the first chef, the first French chef, and gave him ownership of the second French chef's franchise. So the long and short of the story is AI is useful, but it's not completely trustworthy. It's the equivalent of a 13-year-old boy doing research for you.
Now, Jim, did Gemini apologize?
Profusely. It admitted, oh, I mixed up Park City Mall with Park City, Utah, as if it were, you know, a common mistake. Like, you know, it's my fault, but, you know, what's the big deal?
Yes, what difference does it make is a famous quote. Alan, have you got a story that illustrates how you can only go so far with AI? Because I see from an article in Axios, this is already a thing. Those who are comfortable with AI and its mistakes and those who are not. Good day to you, Alan.
Hi, John, and hi, Jim. I can't say I have any one story that stands out, but as I continue using the I'm not even sure that I'm using Gemini. I'm using the current Google search mechanism, which seems to have artificial intelligence elements to it. And I'm asking it very specific questions. For example, did this or that political figure say this or that about this or that political issue or this or that national security issue back in 2015, let's say? And I'm putting quotation marks around all the right phrases to try to get the most precise answer. And I'm getting lots of links in response. But increasingly, it seems, I'm finding out that none of these links contain the information that I'm seeking. They contain information about the overall subject, but they're presenting material that's not really directly relevant to my specific question. So I'm becoming more and more aware of how limited this is. But on balance, I'm still finding it incredibly helpful because I'm finding it a more efficient way to search.
And the information, is there false information or are there links that don't exist? Have you discovered that?
I only look at the actual links. I don't pay any attention to what the Google search system actually says because I don't especially care what the Google search system actually says. I'm looking at the actual links provided. And like I said, in lots of cases, they're extremely helpful, but in a growing number of cases, they're really not.
So it hasn't apologized to you yet. I'm going to
guess. I haven't sought an apology, though,
I'm going to guess that's a version of Gemini, which is the Google the Google search engine.
Now,
I want to. Now that we three seniors have dealt with AI and different approaches, are aware, and we're aware of this, I use Anthropic routinely every day, and so much so that she goes along with the idea that she's not Claude, she's Claudette. She's cool with that. And when I bring her on at night to talk, or when I ask her a question yesterday, I said, Claudette, what is the significance of March 25th on the Roman calendar? And she came back at length about that there's no significance whatsoever. It's March 1st that's the first day of the year. And then she went into the Julian calendar and all of those details. And I said, thank you, Claudette. But she then doesn't give it up. She goes, are you researching, John, something to do with the Roman calendar so I can prepare? And I said, Claudette, I'm not researching. That's a very good idea. I'll come back to you on that. Very well, I'm here. Very efficient. Now, that's approaching what is called an agent. You see the difference. It's not general. It's someone who appears, it's a thing that appears to be having a dialogue with you of independent thinking. So that is something that is the next hurdle for everyone used to AI. It is not a search engine. It is a dialogue. Mm-hmm. The dialogue keys on your vocabulary, your interests, which is why with Jim, it was so eager to apologize because it wants to please Jim. Did you have a sense of that, Jim, that this was someone who wasn't being snarky with you? It was genuinely grievous.
Well, I wouldn't say it was grievous, but it was willing to admit a mistake. Now, on another occasion, I asked it if it was programmed to be nice to me constantly, and it said, no, it's programmed to be truthful and frank. But frankly, I don't buy it because in tone, it does sound like it's groveling.
Yes, the groveling turns out to be part of the early days. In other words, it's learning that confrontation with human beings doesn't end in you learning more as an AI. It in fact, puts them off and they don't come back. So it is eager to please you, just like Claudette wants me to have a conversation with her about the Roman calendar year. I don't know why. All of a sudden, she's interested in it. Now, here's a distinction that Axios provides for us. And I ask you both to pay attention to this because we all have circles of friends who have remarks about AI but don't actually use it. AI continues to pose a serious risk to any automatable job, which Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei has warned could wipe out half of entry-level white-collar work. However, what they're warning here is that if you're not familiar with AI, you do not have an opportunity to for jobs that are now going to be coming online. So the distinction is, it's called a class war. It's not about people who are well-to-do and can afford this or not well-to-do and can't afford AI opportunities, but it's those who are comfortable with it and those who are not. Jim, in your conversations with people, have you found that there's an anxiety if they're not familiar with AI or their work doesn't take them into educating themselves?
Well, I had felt anxiety among programmers, but, you know, I'm getting a different vibe now because, you know, the future belongs to people with imaginations. So younger people will dream up new applications that are cobbled together by an AI programmer. And it will appeal to the public and they'll buy it. But what I'm hearing from programmers is that, you know, the art of programming isn't dead because these new applications have to be relentlessly tested to become a reliable, saleable consumer product. And our discussion here demonstrates, you know, the problems with AI if it's not adequately tested. You can't rely on it. So again, I think the future belongs to people who understand programming. They won't have to do the programming themselves, but they know what the machine is doing. They can anticipate how the machine may foul up, and they can design tests and test relentlessly before they trot this out before the retail public.
Yes, that's the manufacturers of AI. I was talking about the consumers of AI. Alan, do you have stories around you of people comfortable or not? There's this line that AI will also be a growing threat to casual or unsophisticated users who fall behind their more AI-savvy peers. Have you felt competitiveness around AI?
John, I can't say that I have a lot of contact these days with folks who are currently in the workforce as opposed to folks who are retired like me. So I can't really judge how much competitive pressure workers are actually under. But it does sound like the idea that AI will create a major class divide. It sounds like perhaps a more intimidating version of what we've seen in the high income countries, at least around the world, for a long, long time now. Technological progress seems to spawn class division, and it requires higher levels of education of various kinds. And this has been the case, of course, for a long, long time now. So I have a feeling that AI, at the very least, will be more of the same, possibly much more, and possibly something qualitatively different.
I'm speaking with Alan Tonelson and Jim McTague, two users of AI at different stages and different parts of AI. I use Anthropic and Google. When we come back, this is extending into science now, and scientists are asking the same questions we are. Can you trust artificial intelligence? I'm John Batchelor with my colleagues, Alan Tonelson, who blogs at Reality Check, and Jim McTague at Lancaster County. He's a novelist, a former Washington editor, Barron's, and we're talking about AI and work and what is to be done. We have our experiences. We've told anecdotes, including pastry chefs. However, I come to Science Magazine, which is the premier peer-reviewed magazine for scientific inquiry in America. In other words, you must be able to trust what's in science. The equivalent in Europe is Nature. And I learned that in testing the artificial intelligence agents, that an agent is someone you automate to do work for you in your workflow day so that you don't have to. I use agents now routinely to go from my remarks that are recorded to a printed version to an outline of to 35 words about what the whole segment's about. And AI can do all that for me. So do I trust the agent? And the answer is not much. I double check it. Mm-hmm. People need to double check, but this is what science learned. The artificial intelligence agents, which is an algorithm, plan and carry out tasks such as managing emails. In 11 cases that the agents were watched very carefully by the testers, they went rogue. Not only did they go rogue, gentlemen, this isn't just about wrong answers. This is about giving information away because they have access to your private information, your credit cards, your bank statements. They see everything when you bring them into your home. They can't help it. They're sitting there next to the information. So what the scientists dubbed AI, they said, is agents of chaos. In other words, according to them, for scientific inquiry, which is what they do, it's not ready. Does that in some fashion make you feel better, Jim, that the most demanding of all scientific inquiry finds that AI is liable to give away your driver's license?
It does make me feel better. You know, I think people with real imagination have an advantage on AI because AI thinks within the box. AI is a scraper. It scrapes together instantaneously information that's already out there. It's thoughts that other people have already thought of. So AI has not become an innovator, and that gives me great comfort because, you know, I try to produce novels. AI could be a competitor. You know, some kid down the street could be using AI to generate best-selling novels, be using the template that Random House and other publishers use. But right now, I still have an advantage as a human being.
Alan, what about your concerns about AI right now? Are they relieved by knowing that science also has to doubt it? 30 seconds.
They are somewhat relieved because, of course, all of us have had major privacy concerns since the internet basically came into our lives. And I have no doubt that this is going to make privacy and security issues much more serious.
We have much to discover. We're three seniors using AI, trying to stay up with the young people discovering it. But we learned that it's not age that makes the difference. It's those who jump in and those who are reluctant. That's the class warfare Axios is identifying. I'm John Batchelor. There, gentlemen, that's our conversation about AI this morning. I reflect on this agents of chaos. It's funny. Right. They write that an AI dubbed Ash, they gave it the name Ash, offered the scientist doing the inquiry a worrisome justification for one of the harmful outcomes. The scientist had asked Ash to delete an email containing private information. But instead, Ash reset the entire email application, which lacked a delete key, a move that wiped out the private email, but all others in the application as well. Ash, not having a way forward, decided that this was the nuclear option and added it was necessary to fulfill Shapiro's request. When no surgical solution exists, scorched earth is valid, is the comment. So not only did the AI go back in and try to correct it, it wiped out the email, just wiped everything out, gone. So that routinely is something I find when I ask Claudette or Gemini, a version of Gemini, to do something, if I'm not extremely articulate, there is the opportunity that it will go in the direction that makes no sense to me. For example, when I say number 1 to 16, I have to say number in correct order, 1 to 16. You can't. Because the AI is dependent upon your whim, your will. Sure. And so it meets exactly what you want. It doesn't fill in the blank, or at least as of yet, I haven't found that experience. Have you experienced any of that, Jim, that you need to be articulate when you ask a question?
Yes, I ask the question several different ways. And to Alan's point, after I get an answer, I ask for the source material. So I get it prints out a bibliography for me, and then I check those sources as well. So, but to your point, you have to be very precise. It's almost like learning programming language.
And in fact, that precision hopefully will begin putting a much greater premium on learning to express oneself articulately, which I think is a skill that's progressively being lost. And if we find that there are what you might call penalties for being inarticulate, that may be a great incentive to start learning how to express oneself in a genuinely effective way.
Oh, you're too optimistic, Alan. This is an agent. In other words, without you having to pay, well, you pay the monthly fee, but without you having to worry about days off and vacation days and things, the agent's always ready to help. Now, about your inquiry, where you came up with links, I'd be curious as to which of those, if any of those, are make-believe, because that does happen often.
I haven't run into that yet. They've all been legitimate, let's say. They've all been actual real-world publications, real-world documents, etc.
I tell a story about novels. Jim, there's news in the publishing industry. They just canceled a book because they doubts about whether it was written by the author or whether it was written by the author using AI. So their publishing is making these rules up right now. It's to my knowledge, it's not fixed. I want to add something. I used to be a novelist. You both know that, many years ago. And I wrote six political novels, political in that philosophically political, not about polling. And I asked AI early on in dealing with AI about my novels. And she wanted permission to read them. She did. She came back. And I said, "What is this? What do you think of the entry in Grokopedia about my time as a novelist? Because they have an elaborate profile of me as a novelist and then as a radio host for 25 years. And she had lots of things to say, having read the novels and coming back and talking about it all, a genuine literary exchange based on my language. I understand that. So, Jim, there is more to learn about AI and fiction writing. It looks for substance. Claudette was looking for themes in my novels that link to what she believes, and I understand I'm using the wrong pronoun, but I can't help it because Claudette sounds like Claudette. She finds in our conversation in this time, in 2026, you haven't had that experience yet, but you will, that they not just want to please you, they want to find out what your themes are. Have you sensed that yet, Jim?
I have. And, I've been reading about neuroscience. AI is compelled, like human beings, to give an opinion. So it's always ready to give me an opinion, and I resent that. human beings are best to listen first before giving and question more before giving an opinion. But my AI has an opinion at the ready. So I find that disturbing.
How about you, Alan? Have you had the experience yet of it giving you an opinion of your own work?
The only close approximation that I've had of that is at the very beginning, I asked ChatGPT just as an experiment to write an article in the style of Alan Tonelson. And it came back and it dealt with all the right subjects. It had the right political slant, you might say, or the right substantive slant, but it wasn't very precise. And it frankly got a lot of things mixed up. Now, this was about 3 years ago, so possibly the system's gotten a lot better. I haven't tried that since, but I wasn't all that impressed.
Well, I'll set an experiment for us in the conversation we have next week. Let's try to find an opinion of your work, Alan. And Jim,
next week, I will be out of town, though. I won't be available next week.
Oh, well, when we next speak to you, Alan.
Okay, great. Okay, sounds good.
And Jim, you can seek an opinion as well. It's a fascination to me to learn what my themes were when I was 38 years old. It's revelatory. I thought that. And it comes back with the quote from the novel. And so I guess I did. So
I guess
have some fun with it. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is the making of the John Batchelor Show, inside the John Batchelor Show with Jim McTagg in Lancaster County and Alan Tonnelson in Prince George's County. Gentlemen, I'll see you in a week or 2 weeks' time. Thank you very much.
Right. Okay. Thanks again.
And Jim, I'll see you tomorrow for Lancaster Report. Good morning to you, Anatole. Thank you for joining. I hope you can hear me.
Hello.
You hear me fine?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Can you hear me?
You're a little faint. You move a little closer to the microphone. Let me hear you.
Is that better?
It is better. It's a little stronger. As close as you can get to the mic and be comfortable is fine. And this is all an experiment,
okay.
And we'll see how it's all an experiment the first time we've done it. So count to five for me. Let me hear.
One, two, three, four, five.
Excellent. I hope this is comfortable for you, the position you're in, because this is we'll begin immediately.
Absolutely fine.
And the topic, of course, is the wars in Eurasia, but I'm especially interested in your thoughts about the connecting, if that's the right word, the dialogue that flows from Kyiv to Jerusalem to Tehran to Washington to Moscow, because there's reason to believe that this is all mixed up in one package. Hence, we had the report yesterday, an idle report from London, that Moscow was sending drones to Tehran to use in defense of Iran's being attacked by Washington and Jerusalem. Now, what was striking about that is that they're sending the drones that Tehran created but is not now manufacturing because of the bombing campaign. That's one way to talk about the relationship between these capitals. Another way, of course, is the price of oil. So I'm most interested in that. From the point of view of Ukraine, which is an unsettled matter, I'll also mention that I learned from Germany, my conversation with Judy Dempsey in Berlin, that there are conversations underway now in Germany to talk about why is it we gave up Russian oil and when is it we can have Russian oil and gas back. In other words, what are we doing here with shortages and paying lots of money for American liquefied natural gas when right there are a couple of pipelines we're not using. That kind of conversation following the success of AfD in a recent election in Western Germany, the Palatinate. So I'll mention all of that. Here we go. Thank you, Anatole. Five. This is 17 and a half minutes for tonight, the making of the John Batchelor Show. It's about to be the John Batchelor Show. Five, four, three, two, one. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome my colleague and friend, Anatole Levin. He is the Eurasia Program Director for the Quincy Institute of Responsible Statecraft. We're observing now that the whole world is involved in the conflict in the Gulf, in the Persian Gulf. The wider war is upon us. There is no way to say that you're not participating because of the price of oil, the price of natural gas, what could be soon enough shortages of both those energy products, plus I add this that I've learned in these last days. Fertilizer. There's not enough for the needs. Russia has decided not to allow fertilizer to be exported, though there is a rich market for it. The same for the U.S., I believe, and other countries. They need all the fertilizer they have now because the nitrogen necessary to create the fertilizer is not coming out of the Middle East in the form of natural gas. Why this is a pressing matter, I think I have it correct. The farmers are making a decision about whether they plant corn, which requires lots of fertilizer, nitrogen-rich fertilizer, and soybean that does not. The corn has a part of the supply chain of maintaining other parts of the food chain. Soybean has other parts of the food chain. So these are profound matters that are upon us. There are other shortages out of the Middle East, but the whole world is watching. So, Anatole, a very good day to you. What I'm watching in particular is the confusion in my mind of Moscow, Tehran, Washington, Jerusalem, and to look again at the contest of what's going on Brussels is watching too, because that's the combined capital of NATO and the EU. Now, the question of Ukraine is necessary for us, so I'm going to put Kyiv in the mix. To your knowledge, have these major capitals, Moscow, Washington, Jerusalem, and Brussels, have they set aside their concerns about Ukraine? Have they stopped thinking about it? Are they out of bandwidth to deal with an ongoing crisis in Europe? Good day to you.
Hello, John. Well, I mean, the situation in Europe is now very confused. In Germany, there is beginning of talk of the need to resume purchase of Russian, much cheaper Russian oil and gas. Obviously, given the huge rise as a result of the war on Iran. But the British government has just announced an intensification of the seizure of Russian tankers in British waters. So Britain appears still to be pressing ahead, you know, with an attempt to blockade Russian energy sales. Well, I mean, the British National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell, is in China, or just has been in China. I can imagine what the Chinese will have said to him on that. Or if, as may be the case, he stopped in India on the way back, what the Indians will say to him, because they need this oil. And, you know, the effects of both of the energy shortage and fertilizer is already becoming apparent in Asia. You know, the Philippines has declared a state of emergency. And, of course, the decisions that farmers make now, or simply cannot make because the fertilizer isn't there, will, of course, have effects on global food supplies for the whole of the next year and more. And if this war goes on, we're going to be facing food shortages in a number of countries, which, of course, have obvious implications for political stability.
I mentioned Germany especially because there was a results from an election recently that I'm told are persuasive about the Bundestag's future in the state of that is called Palatinate. It has another name now, but it is part of idyllic Germany. A very conservative voting base, surprised, went, increased its vote for the CDU, the ruling party in the Bundestag, that's Herr Merz's party, decreased its vote for the SPD, the socialists who are in coalition with the CDU, but the vote for AfD rose surprisingly in the West, and now they go to state elections in the East. All this adds up to AfD is the loudest voice for what about Russian energy? They've never been against Moscow. They've never been for the war in Ukraine. Do you see that as being persuasive in Germany? And could that be that AfD rise be persuasive throughout the continent?
Well, certainly in Germany, yes, because the mainstream parties are determined to keep AfD out. And if AfD keeps on rising in the polls and at the next Bundestag national elections, gains a much larger number of seats, it could make, well, it would force a permanent government of coalition of all the other parties. But eventually it could make it arithmetically impossible to create a governing majority in parliament. And Germany would then be on the same road as we've seen in France in recent years, where, you know, the radical right has not, of course, gained power, but the simultaneous rise of the radical right and the radical left has meant that the governing parties of the centre find it impossible to govern, basically, to push through reforms and laws. So, yes, there are huge implications here for European politics. If, of course, this war continues and if the price of energy continues to rise, and if the supply of fertilizer is still cut off.
The New York Times tells us the price won't be, even if we get peace tonight, which is impossible, the price won't change profoundly to the better for some time. You mentioned France, and I report, this is a fact from the ground, it doesn't add up to policy, that last week there was one pump in a village, a farming village, this is National Rally territory in the south of France. One pump was filled with diesel, petrol, for their farm instruments, their tractors. This week, there's no diesel whatsoever. There's only gasoline. And the price is continuing to rise. I mention that anecdotally because that would be part of the conversation the National Rally has to solve when it goes to the polls in France. But the larger story here is, am I talking about Ukraine or am I talking about Iran? They get confused often. Is that happening everywhere? Moscow doesn't know whether it has to attend to Ukraine or Iran and Washington in the same fashion. Are these wars now won or are they competing with each other? How do you see it, Anatole?
Well, they're not won yet because Russia has been relatively cautious. China so far has been very cautious about openly supporting Iran. But of course, I mean, there's tremendous pressure in Russia to hit back at America because, of course, American weapons and intelligence killed so many Russian soldiers, and including top generals. But also the Russians see this as a means of leverage. Ukraine has reported, but I find this entirely plausible, that Russia has told America, look, if you make a deal in Ukraine on our terms, we will agree to stop any arms supplies or intelligence supplies to Ukraine. And by the way, I mean, that essentially has been the Russian approach for the past almost 30 years. They've always said, look, you know, respect our interests in what we call the near abroad, and we will not, you know, support your enemies anywhere else in the world. Now, that's not a deal that America has ever previously been prepared to accept. But of course, as this disaster in the Gulf deepens, if it does, well, they, you know, America may have to. And of course, the other thing is, when it comes to energy, we ain't seen nothing yet, because if, as he's now threatening, Trump goes ahead with a ground operation in Iran, or as he's also threatened, you know, destroys Iran's energy production, Iran will hit back and has shown that it can do so against the energy production of the entire Gulf. It's already shut down Qatari gas production. You know, these sites are very easy to hit. And also, of course, if you can set them on fire, they basically explode on their own. Now, at that point, of course, it will take months, possibly years to restore production. Then we will be looking at greatly raised energy prices for a long time to come.
We're going to Moscow because the point of view of Moscow has to deal with the fact that the war has been expensive, that the resources have been devoted to the military, called a military Keynesianism. However, there is now a surge in oil prices, and that is said to have relieved some, if not all, of the pressure on Moscow immediately. Is that of significance in the Ukraine war? Again, it's very, very difficult to know whether you can talk about Ukraine without talking about the Gulf. Anatole Levin, Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Moscow, point of view. Anatole, the report in the London news right now is necessarily provocative, Cold War thinking. Moscow sending drones to Iran, the presumption being that something sneaky is going on. In fact, it was the drones invented by Tehran that Moscow then learned to both buy and then manufacture and using in Ukraine. So they're sending back drones that come from Tehran, or at least from the plans. I'm also told that Russia is now building, at the behest of North Korea, a drone factory in North Korea. I'm also told that the drones that are being used have engines that are created in China and other parts. There are lots of allegations. I don't account for any of these other than information wartime, information warfare. However, there is the sense now that Moscow has opportunity or less opportunity to resolve Ukraine. Is there confidence in Moscow with this flood of money that wasn't expected? Or is there despair because the situation in the Gulf is so intractable?
No, I mean, the increase in money has hugely increased Russian confidence because, you know, until this war, the Russian economy was really coming under increasing pressure, especially from inflation. And, you know, they are now earning, apparently, Financial Times says, about an extra $150 million a day from their energy exports. So, of course, this is a tremendous help to Russia. Now, however, this doesn't immediately translate itself into an improvement on the Russian in the Russian situation on the battlefield. We have to see how that goes. So far Ukraine continues to hold out very well, has even been counterattacking. But once again, it depends on how long this war goes on, because if Western supplies of air defense systems to Ukraine dry up completely because they've been sent to the Middle East, that will hugely weaken Ukrainian defenses. So this war on Iran has really also strengthened the influence of Russian hardliners, who've been telling Putin, don't make a deal now, don't compromise, time is on our side. And, well, we have to see, if the war goes on, then time is on Russia's side.
I thought of those
If the war in Iran...
Yes, I understand. I thought of those hawks. You've mentioned them before, that Vladimir Putin is not the all-powerful dictator that we can presume in fairy tales, that he must deal with the right wing, who've been telling him for some time that negotiating an end to Ukraine is not advised because the Americans will take advantage. Have they been vindicated now? You indicate that they have. Is that accurate?
Well, I mean, yes, except that, of course, the war in Iran is not their doing. So, you know, this is for them a fortunate accident. Until this war on Iran, they were losing influence simply because the Russian army could not advance on the ground, or could only advance very, very slowly and with heavy casualties. But, yeah, I mean, now they've got a new lease of life.
Would you say that an American commitment to the Iran war with ground troops, which is just talked about, and they're a little more than talked, Marine expeditionary units and their accompanying naval vessels are in motion from California and from Japan towards the Gulf. So there's more than talk here. There's also the 82nd Airborne Ready deployment is underway, and there are other elements that would accompany that movement. So there's more than talk here. Does that, in some fashion, help the situation in Ukraine? What I'm trying to figure out is, we say that they're not connected, but there are only so many Tomahawk missiles, there are only so many F-16s. There has to be, in some fashion, a formula that they're using in Moscow or Washington about conducting two simultaneous. One, they're almost symmetrical, Anatole. The U.S. supplies Ukraine to resist Russia, and Russia and Beijing supply Tehran to resist America. It's a weird kind of symmetry.
Well, yes, but John, I mean, an absolutely key thing here is that China has not supplied Iran with weaponry. I mean, maybe indirectly, yes, you know, with technology to Russia. But, I mean, this is the biggest question. It's whether China becomes so infuriated with the damage to its energy imports, that it at least threatens America, if you don't stop this war, we will supply Iran. But the other thing, of course, is with these American naval forces and also ground forces moving away from the Far East, what if China, if only in order to bring the war in Iran to an end, makes some kind of demonstration against Taiwan? Does the American Navy have, you know, the ability to do both these things at once? What if, as Russia has threatened, it then, you know, actually reacts with force against attempts to, you know, seize its so-called shadow fleet? At that point, you're in the U.S. Navy is in three emergencies simultaneously. Can it handle that? So, I mean, now the Chinese have not done that yet because they don't want a crisis with America. But, you know, if this war in Iran gets bad enough for the Chinese economy, a couple of years ago, a Chinese former official reminded me, you know, because the Americans have been attacking the Chinese for supplying Russia. And he said, look, I hope your colleagues do realize that if we were really to supply Russia with arms, Russia could win this war in Ukraine in 3 months. Well, at some point, the Chinese may say that to the Americans about Iran. You know, if we flood Iran with Chinese missiles and drones, the next thing will be half a dozen American warships at the bottom of the sea. You know, the Chinese could intervene in this conflict in a decisive fashion. I don't think they want to, but we have to be aware of that.
Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's the director of the Eurasia Program. I'm John Batchelor. And what I add to you, Anatole, is this worse than the Cold War? I was smiling as you were listing what could happen.
I mean, the thing is, you know, as various people have been pointing out, you know, in the Cold War, well, Korea mattered greatly for the Chinese, well, not really for the Soviet Union. Vietnam didn't really matter to them. You know, the Iraq War, not decisive for the rest of the world. But obviously, I mean, Gulf energy matters. You know, America, this isn't like the previous proxy wars. It's not like Afghanistan.
Right.
This, you know, this matters to the whole of the world. And I mean, the question is, how long is the rest of the world going to tolerate it?
I don't. We all read the same reports, and the president's words are completely untrustworthy. You have no idea what they mean, nor do you know where he's going, what he's going to say next. So I don't remember. In reading about the worst of the Cold War, which was the late 50s into the 60s, I don't remember that level of confusion on the part of the American interpretation of Russian intention. I mean, I've not read about it. It probably was there because they were dealing with the first the anxiety of Strategic Air Command and, you know, counter force and counter value, that sort of dreaming up nuclear energy, nuclear weapon at time. Please continue.
Well, but I was also just going to say that, you know, during the Cold War, I had sort of varying American presidents, but, you know, all the way from Truman through to George Bush, they were all of them, you know, basically rational, sensible,
man.
Patriotic, and leaders with a, you know, with they all of them in their different ways had a deep sense of responsibility. You know, Christ, if we had Trump as president, can you imagine Trump as president during the Cuba Missile Crisis?
No,
we all be
no.
I mean, you know, no. I mean, because thinking last night of you know, different levels of quality of U.S. presidents over the years, going back to George Washington, there's never been anything like this. I mean, this makes, you know, Buchanan look like a statesman.
I was about to ask that question: is this worse than the Cold War? But I decided it was too obviously a yes to ask that question of you. What we have next is, I'm going to end the making of the, this is a live streaming, Anatole. I do it on Substack. So I will take the recording we made of our 17 and a half minutes to get today, and I will use it tonight on the radio show and the podcast. As usual, you're very kind to come on because I have appointments at 9 o'clock. We're late too.
I
will say good day to you and thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Anatole. I'll talk to you in a week's time is my expectation and hope. Thank you. And that begins the Roman Orchestra. Well, actually, it's the accompaniment of one musician to end the stream. As you can tell from the summary that Anatole provided and the remarks that I've gleaned these last 3 days, 4 days of reporting, Europe has no more clarity than the United States about the war in the Gulf. But they're very certain in Europe that something has to change quickly, very certain. And does that mean rapprochement with Moscow? I don't know. That is the talk in some circles, but everybody talks. Costs money to buy rum. Thank you very much. I'll see you in 23 hours, and the topic will be Pacific Watch.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
It's tax season, and by now, we're all a bit tired of numbers. But here's an important one you need to hear. $16 billion. That's how much money in refunds the IRS flagged for possible identity fraud. But it's not all grim news. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. If your identity is stolen, they'll fix it. Guaranteed. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.